The following is a recording of a candidate forum held on Tuesday, October 18th, 2022, at the Gallatin Gateway Community Center. The forum was organized by the Willing Workers Ladies' Aid, and it featured Doug Campbell, Dr. Jane Gillette, and Alana Griffith, candidates for House District 64, Randy Chamberlain and Pat Flowers, candidates for Senate District 32, and Jennifer Boyer, candidate for Gallatin County Commission. The other county commission candidate, Joe Flynn, did not attend the event.
Welcome everyone to our candidate forum. This is Willing Workers Ladies Aid, is the host of this night, and we are very appreciative of your all coming. And we are a charitable, nonprofit charitable organization, and we do events like this and many other events for our community. You notice we have a book in the back room that we made, and we're wrapping off that book if you want to take another look at it. You can do so at the end of the park. And we're very happy to have candidates here. And we can, we're going to have the candidates introduce themselves. They'll do a better job of it than I will. And our moderator for the evening is Sally Masoner, and she's from the League of Women Voters. And she's very experienced being a moderator for these events. So we're very pleased to have her here. So I think we can start.
But I'm a timer, so you have to let me take.
I'll give you the time.
Do the bottom of that.
The format of the evening is each candidate gets 2 minutes to introduce him or herself. And then we would ask the candidates to prepare one question, a different question for the legislature than for the county commission. And they'll have 2 minutes to answer the questions. And we'll let you know before we start about that. And then finally, you get a lot of questions, and you may ask questions. So hang on, and I'm going to let these people introduce themselves. They each have 2 minutes. There's a timer. And who would like to be first to introduce him or herself?
All right. Thank you, Workers Ladies Aid of Gallatin Gateway. Thank you, Sally. I really appreciate it. My name is Alana Griffith. I was born, raised, and lived, work, and employed in House District 64. I was raised over by the Hot Springs. Okay, so I was raised over by the Hot Springs area in Four Corners, and my parents are Gary and Wendy Griffith. They're right there. A lot of you may know Gary. He was the chairman of the Montfort School Board for 30 years. And a lot of you may know Linda because she worked with Eagle Mountain for 20 years, 10 of them as the executive director of Eagle Mountain. They raised me to believe that we need to give back to our communities in ways that best suit our particular skills. And after graduating from Montfort, I came back after law school, and I've been representing you for 20 years, 2 decades of legal work on your behalf. I am a contract attorney, which means people think that's kind of.
I think it's really exciting. I represent small businesses, contractors, developers, and HOAs drafting the rules and regulations that they have to live by every single day. I understand the importance of word placement and word choices and how that can have unintended consequences. So looking at statutes, drafting statutes, I do that every single day. I'm also Secretary Treasurer of the Montana Bar Association, and as such, I have to work with the legislature quite often. And the bar is worried about the attacks on the judiciary and the attacks on the rule of law. And we took a study to try to figure out what was going on. And honestly, we have ourselves to blame. We have looked at the legislative makeup, and out of 150 legislators, nine have law degrees, 6 are licensed in Montana, and 3 actually practice law. That's it. So we as a bar said, we're not going to do this. We're going to have our members start to show up. We're not the end-all be-all. We need everyone, but you also need attorneys. And I don't lead from behind. I lead from in front, so I threw my hat in the ring. Thank you very much.
I'm going to step out from behind the kids' table here so you can see me. I think I'll be hard-pressed to make 30 seconds of introduction here, but... my name is Doug Campbell. I'm an independent, but I'm running on the Libertarian ticket, so you'll see an L next to my name. I was born and raised here in the Gallatin Valley in Bozeman in 1963. Graduated high school, went to my first 2 years of college at MSU. Finished up college at Arizona State and got hired at a college. I'm in electrical engineering. For the last 20 years, I've owned my own business, as well as worked for the energy industry, as well as many other industries. You won't have seen my name because I, personally, I think it should be illegal to contribute to a candidate's campaign or for a candidate to spend money on a campaign. I got my feelers in politics in 2000, working for Senator McCain during his primary run, and campaign finance reform was my big issue, and I think that we still need that. That's not an issue that I can fight for here. Oh, I made a minute. Great. however, I think it's really important that that we talk from the center. Everything in nature is a bell curve, and all of the majority is in the center. And so when we're talking from the left or the right, we're missing a lot of the point. The greatest number of people in Montana are independents. Ooh, I made a minute and 30. And so I don't have any political ideology. My objective is solutions. And that's how I aim to legislate should you elect me. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for hosting this event, and thanks to all of you for taking the time to attend. My name's Jennifer Boyer, and I'm running for Gallatin County Commission. I'm inspired to run because I care about this place and because our local government impacts our daily lives in fundamental ways. It's our roads and bridges, it's our parks and trails, it's critical public safety like sheriff and 911, it's how our communities grow, and even critical social services like mental health. A little bit about myself. I grew up in a small town where my dad was the local veterinarian. I live on a farm with my husband and son east of Bozeman. My husband does aerial photography, and our son is a sophomore at Bozeman High School. I learned early the value of service and discipline under pressure, growing up helping my dad in his clinic, saving the lives of beloved pets. And from those early days, I've continued to show up, often in pressure under fire situations, including working on highly charged issues like drought and community development. And I don't need to tell anyone here that our county is growing and changing at breakneck speed, and it's causing a lot of worry and anxiety. And there's three areas I'm excited to lean into as county commission. One is housing and affordability, bringing a diversity of approaches to bring more housing options across the county, including opportunities to expand our transit. The second area is around community planning, how we're going to grow that is compatible in a way with existing neighborhoods and also sensitive to our environment. The third area is water management. It's critically important that we manage our water resources as an entire watershed across jurisdictions. I've built drought plans and management plans in other communities, and I know how to lead those efforts here. Thank you.
I'm Randy Chamberlain. Thank you for putting this on. My wife of 40 years is right here in the second row, and I'm very proud of her. I'm a husband, a father, and a grandfather. We've lived in this district for 27 years, and we have a lot of memories. We have a lot of memories right here. We have memories of our kids playing basketball in the school right across the road here. Now we're watching our grandkids play basketball over there. Right next door, we've had my son was a volunteer fireman for a number of years, and great memories there, and also some difficult ones. One night at training, he had a spontaneous blood bleed in his spine. That led us to a trip to Portland in an airplane. Yes, a lot of memories here. But I've been self-employed for 35 years, been a builder. We've put a number of homes together for first-time home buyers, and I'll tell you, that is very gratifying. So I think I bring a little bit of a unique experience to some of this affordable housing. But yeah, and we continue to be self-employed. I have a steel fab company now, and we're very active in the community. So thank you for being here.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jane Gillette. I'm the elected representative for House District 64. My mom was a secretary. My dad removed asbestos from buildings. And I grew up very poor. As a matter of fact, I lived in my early part of my childhood in a camper. But my parents taught me about the value of education and that you can lose everything in your life, but no one can ever take away your education. I was a single mom. I worked two jobs while I was getting my baccalaureate. And then for my doctorate, I received a full-ride Air Force scholarship. I spent 14 years in the United States Air Force, where I learned service before self. I was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, gosh, 20 years ago, and I fell in love with Montana. I was recruited by Community Health Partners. I started their first dental practice and then later went on to own my own private dental office. But all the while, I was really interested in research, and I was continuing to do research. I managed a $30 million NIH package of grants where we did translational science throughout the Northwest. And so eventually, I left private practice, went back to school, got a master's in public health and a certificate in clinical research methods, and then went full-time into research and healthcare consulting. My research interests are health disparities research, so why some populations get sick and some don't, and then translational science, so that's how you get scientific findings into practice. Recently, I published a book chapter on evidence-informed policymaking, which is how you get science into the policymaking process. My research interests tend to focus on children and families. 20 years ago, I started a nonprofit that focused on maternal and child health. About a decade ago, I started another one that, again, focuses on children, the disabled, the elderly, Head Start kids. Every year, we see about 13,000 children in schools across Montana. Not too long ago, I received from HRDC the Future Generations Award for my recognition and contribution to early childhood, and I'm the longtime treasurer of Save the Mothers, which works in Uganda to save children and moms from dying in childbirth, and I'm the vice chair of the Yellowstone Girls and Boys Ranch, one of two places in Montana where children in mental health crisis can receive residential psychiatric care. Thank you.
Thanks, Sally. Good evening. My name is Pat Flowers. I'm the state senator for Senate District 32. Just for perspective, for those of you who don't know, it runs from campus on the east side all the way through Four Corners and everything south through West Yellowstone. Really diverse district and a fantastic honor for me to be able to represent it. I want to thank the Willing Workers Ladies Aid for this event. I think it's a real gift to voters and a gift to candidates both to have this opportunity. And I've been to many events here, many great meals here, and I want to acknowledge how important I think the work that the Ladies Aid does in creating community. It's really hard to find these days. You have it here, and I really thank you for that. I'm also married. My wonderful wife is here tonight, and we were married about 8 years ago. We each have two daughters. We merged families. My wife died 16 years ago almost, and so I raised my girls a bit by myself and then had the good fortune to connect up with Melissa, and now we have a bigger family. My education and career was entirely focused on natural resources. The first half of my career was in forestry. Ultimately, I was managing the state forest management lands, those trust lands that support our schools. And the second half of my career was in fish and wildlife, and I managed the Region 3 Office for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks for 15 years. So my orientation I carry also to the legislature and serve on state fish and game and state natural resources. All that experience I had in both those jobs, I can apply directly. Bringing people together around the table to solve tough problems. And so hopefully I'll get the chance to do that for another 4 years. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I'm so sorry, Pat. I'll try to do better, everybody, but keep me honest. The candidates were asked to prepare a question that they have 2 minutes each to answer. And Jennifer is the only candidate for county commission, so she has a different question than everybody else. And the questions, who wants to, do you want to start first or be last, Jennifer, since you're... Okay. Is that all right with everybody? Okay. The question that was posed to Jennifer was, growth increases the need for additional infrastructure, educational opportunities, law enforcement, county services, and water. Without assistance, current residences feel the brunt of these increases. What are your ideas for meeting these critical needs in equitable ways? And she has 2 minutes.
My question is longer. I just want everyone to realize that I got the long question.
No.
Yeah. Thanks so much. The impacts of growth are complex, diverse, and expensive. I would work to build partnerships, particularly to address our transportation and water management. Regionally, we need to bring the municipalities, our county, our nonprofits, and our major employers together to work on these complex issues. We need to ensure that development pays its way for those new infrastructure needs. We also need to seek grants for improvements, particularly for drought response, trails, and transit services. I have staffed the Planning Coordination Council, which is a committee that is formed of Bozeman, Belgrade, and Gallatin County that did the Triangle Community Plan and Trails Plan. And that is a great working model of how those collaborative partnerships can get important work done. I'd also work with the state legislature to look for creative ways to reduce property tax burden, particularly looking at those who are living and working here and reducing their property tax burden and perhaps making up the difference with second, third, and fourth homeowners. I'd look to incentivize ways to support affordability so that nurses, police, teachers, and all of those who are the backbone of our community who want to work here can also afford to live here. Looking at projects like Bridger View and the rest home development that Gallatin County is pursuing right now. Looking at projects like Big Sky's doing to incentivize renting to a local. And public-private partnerships that can support childcare, because that's often almost another mortgage for families. Our county government has almost 100 vacancies right now, and addressing our affordability crisis is critical in being able to fill those vacancies and deliver this whole suite of services that our county provides to our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. And the question for the state what are your ideas for increasing the availability of affordable housing in fast-growing areas such as ours? And who would like to go first? Don't all speak at once.
Thank you, Sally. This is a question that I think is posed kind of in the wrong way, because from my perspective, and this is going to sound like a completely libertarian standpoint, addressing housing affordability at the state level is just the wrong way to look at it. Every single community has its own issues and its own solutions. And for me, I would get the state completely out of the picture as far as local zoning, local development, and allow each community, each county, each city, each local community to find its own solutions. And now those solutions would be market-based. So it sounds counterproductive, like letting the fox into the hen house, but I would actually turn the regulatory portion of zoning and development over to the developers themselves. Now, to counteract that, I would actually remove all of the civil limitations so that they would be responsible for the decisions they made for years down the road. This question that they asked is one, I get to do very few door knocking, very little door knocking, because I work 80 hours a week, two full-time jobs. But this is the one question, thank you, Sally, for asking it, is the question of the day. And how we solve that at the state level is we don't. The state needs to allow each local community to find their own solutions here. When I moved back to home 10 years ago, or more than a decade ago, I was lucky. The market was great. But if I were to do that today, it would be impossible. I would never have been able to move back home, and I would hate for anyone who loves Montana to be restricted from being able to afford to live here.
Thank you, Sally. So make no mistake, the lack of affordable housing right now in Bozeman, or really in much of Montana, is a crisis. This isn't a small problem. It's an absolute crisis. Just ask the folks that are living in their cars and their trailers off the side of 19th. Those are working homeless in Bozeman, and clearly we have a problem. It affects not just kind of human welfare and that basic need for shelter, but it is also affecting our businesses. I have knocked a lot of doors. I've been knocking doors since March, and I've knocked on the doors of numerous business owners who are struggling to find employees because they can't afford to live here. So this goes beyond human welfare. Contrary to what Doug said, I do think the state has a role in this. I think the federal government has a role in this. I think private interests have a role in this, and I think local government all have a role in this. And I think we ought to be working together to try and complement each other's opportunities or efforts to get that done. We should be empowering local communities like Bozeman rather than taking tools away from them like we did in the last legislative session. Local communities do know better how to solve problems, and we should give them that opportunity and work to support them rather than take tools away. We passed a couple of good bills in the last two sessions that address affordable housing. One is the low-income housing tax credit that was passed in 2021 and then vetoed. Hopefully we can bring that back and get it passed in the next session. 2019, we passed a low-interest loan program that allowed for low-income housing to be built with rent-controlled outcomes. So that's some of the stuff the state can do, and I think there's lots of other options that came out of the governor's task force that just completed last week that hopefully we can put some of those ideas in place as well. Thank you.
Affordable housing. It's by far the number one issue that we hear at the doors, no doubt about it. The rising costs, it's supply and demand. It's pretty simple. We have too little supply and too much demand. The price is going up, and we've got to change that. So we have to increase supply to bring the demand down, which will bring the affordability down. So we need to encourage subdivisions instead of discouraging subdivisions. We need to reduce the red tape to get subdivisions through instead of increase it. I know that it's not what we always want to hear, but that's exactly what we need to be able to do. We've got to increase the supply. One of the ways to do that, of course, is to reduce the red tape. Another way I think we can do that is by allowing some manufactured housing. In most subdivisions, that's not allowed, but that's a cheaper way to get houses built. And so we can get some more affordable housing by doing that. Another thing, we have to streamline the process for DEQ. There's one area, and I'm not a big spender, but we need to increase the budget for DEQ so that we can get subdivisions through there. They need more staffing so that we can get subdivisions through in a more timely manner. And instead of them being obstructionists, we need them to help get subdivisions through. I'm much more on the line of Doug's thinking that private enterprise needs to fix this problem, not the government. The government tends to pick winners and losers, and we don't need winners and losers, the government picking them. We need to have private enterprise solve this problem. Thank you.
Yeah, I would have to echo a lot of the comments. I've kind of given up on the concept of affordable housing, by the way. I've reframed my mindset, and I call it obtainable housing now. Maybe I'm getting a little pessimistic and old. But why there's not enough inventory in the market is definitely complex, but mostly it centers around the lack of available construction labor, land use regulations, zoning restrictions, and the lack of developable land. And it can basically be, the solutions to it can basically, at least in my mind, be fit into three categories. The first would be regulatory reform, so streamlining permitting, placing sideboards on zoning, and broadly restoring the rights of landowners to build obtainable housing, especially in areas that are sufficient, that have sufficient infrastructure for fill-in. Sometimes people are a little critical because last session we did away with inclusionary zoning, but you don't have to be an economist to figure out how that equation works. When you have inclusionary zoning, you know, the developers, the construction workers, they make a loss on that, and essentially they pass it on then to the other homeowners. The second bucket is incentives to encourage regulatory reform. So that's tax credits, employer tax credits. There was actually a bill that was passed last session that was vetoed by the governor. I supported it, but it was for employers that provided housing for their employees. Trust, loans, and other incentives that reward local governments for proactively implementing reforms, including TIF districts and deed restrictions. The third bucket is to invest in improved government efficiencies, workforce development, and private sector construction. So elevating the trades and investing in private sector construction, encouraging public-private collaboration, require reporting of short-term rentals, and free up state-owned land so that communities can build on that. And I do have actually two bills in the queue that address both property taxes and the state land leases as well to address those issues. Thank you.
People are wonderfully compliant with the rules. Thank you all. Pardon? Oh, you live? Oh, good. I want to look dangerous. So now we're coming to the part. Oh, God. I'm doing it again. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Right.
All right. This is an area that, of law that I know well. I represent infill developers and affordable housing developers. I represent developers of all size. Look, I am the one who takes them from the ground all the way up. They hire me and pay me a lot of money to get them over the barriers. So I know what the barriers are. And the housing report came back, the governor's task force, on the 14th and agreed with me. The number one barrier is the DEQ. You're absolutely right. And it's not because they're being obstructionist. It is because of the lack of funding. The DEQ is the Department of Environmental Quality. And what they do is they have to approve all the sanitation and all the stormwater drainage plans. And that is not a simple thing that you can hire anyone off the street to do. It takes an engineering degree. And these people can leave the DEQ very easily and get better paying jobs. Right now, my developers, because you can't even get a subdivision permit until you get your COSA from the DEQ, that's Certificate of Subdivision Approval, they are a year behind, a whole year. I can't get product on the market without your help and support to get more money into the DEQ. Second, we need to overhaul the Subdivision Act. It was enacted 49 years ago, people, that's older than me, and with very minor changes. Subdivision law and planning, again, I think it's really exciting. It has changed so much in the last 50 years that there are things that we can implement where you, the people, can have earlier say in what's going on with subdivision laws, and I would like to see that happen. Last, we have to look to our communities as well and look to Big Sky. Their public housing trust, which I'm the pro bono attorney, one of the pro bono attorneys for, has been doing amazing things, including one, getting vacation rentals into long-term leasing by paying the offsetting the costs, and last, the Good Deeds Program, where we are actually paying people up to 20% of the value of their home to place a deed restriction on it that a local must live there forever.
Okay, I'm going to pull myself together here. Now, we're going to come to the part where you get to ask questions. And everybody has a minute to answer the question. I think we've had difficulty this year with candidates being willing to come to these forums. And I think both sides are worried about coming into something that gets ugly. And the discourse, of course, in this country, we all know, has been nothing but ugly for several years. And that's on both sides, probably. Anyway, the answer, you may ask a question of one person. So you could ask Alana a question. but everybody else gets to answer it if they want to. You don't have to answer every question. You can say, I agree with him, her, or just pass. That's fine. So that's how we're going to do this. The gentleman in the blue sweater. That's how we're going to do this. The gentleman in the blue sweater.
I'm only able to ask one question to one candidate, one person. I was looking to be asked both the incumbents, but Senator Flowers, currently we have a large surplus in the budget right now. Very large. I'm talking to the governor just...
Would you make sure you just ask a question, please?
And why has that surplus not been returned to the public yet? My understanding that the Senate was supposed to have a special session, but they passed on it. Why don't we get our money back?
Okay.
Thank you. Great question. And there's a really good reason for that. And that is we have a really robust process that starts this year on almost January 1st, the last 90 days during the legislative session, where we go through the budget very carefully. Every expense, every proposal out of an agency, we review. We also look at revenue projections so we know what's coming in. We also look at existing surplus. This year, we happen to have a large surplus. We take all of that and then decide what we're going to fund, what we're not going to fund, and develop our state budget. And we develop then also our plans for contingency because we have to have a balanced budget and carry a surplus into the next cycle. So going through that process, we'll then come to the conclusion on whether the highest priority with that surplus is to write checks to taxpayers or is it to meet some other high priority need. And that's the logical, detailed process, and that's why not only did I choose not to vote on that, which is qualified as a no, but so did the president of the Senate, so did the president pro tem of the Senate, both Republicans, so did the secretary or the speaker of the House, who's also a Republican. Thank you.
Sorry, that wasn't your fault. That's your fault. No, my fault this time. A minute. Everybody gets a minute to answer the questions. Okay? Thank you. Yeah, sorry. Who else would like to answer that? Yes, Jane.
I love that question. Here's how I think about it. I was one of the legislators that wanted a special session. It was actually closer to $2 billion, but some of it has been already allocated, like Senator Flowers said, for other things. But that brings it down to about $1.4 billion. And the essence of it is, the reality of it is, we overcharged the taxpayers. That's how we got into this place. And if you sold a car to somebody for $5,000 and you accidentally overcharged them and you took in $6,000, you would give that $1,000 back. And in my mind, that's the ethical thing to do. I don't think that we should keep the taxpayers' money and then say, we know better than you on how to spend it. I think we should give it back to them. They need that money now. If we are going to keep it, then I think we have the responsibility to put it into our pension, which is underfunded by $2 billion. That's the responsible thing to do in my mind. Thank you.
Who else would like to answer this? Speak to this question.
I would just agree with Jane.
Did you hear? Did everybody hear that response? Okay. Alana? Duck? Okay. Next question. Yes, ma'am.
Jane, what pension are you talking about?
Okay. I assume you're asking Jane.
Thank you for the question. I'm specifically talking about the teacher's retirement pension. It's, and I have the data up here, but we are, as of 2020, $2 billion short in that right now. And I'd be happy to share that data with you.
Another question. Yes.
My name's Claudia. Thank you for being here. I know this is like tough duty in the trenches, and I just really respect the fact that you're willing to step up and do that. My question is this. As Pat was saying, the district is diverse, right? And last session, I felt quite underrepresented. I wrote some letters. I made some calls on specific issues, and I got a beautiful letter back. detailing, I've done this, I've done that. It doesn't matter who it's from. But what matters to me is how each of you may address a diverse set of interests when you represent such a diverse district, even though you represent a party as well.
Okay.
I just felt powerless after the election. I just would like you to speak, if you would like to that issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Who would like to answer?
You know, that is a great question, because in Four Corners, we see things different than at the university. And, of course, Big Sky, which is a very, very important part of Montana, the money that is generated there with tourism is very important. And then, again, West Yellowstone. They have very different needs. So, you know what? I got to listen to you. I got to listen to you. And I have principles that I live by and that I would consider use to make decisions, but I have to listen to you. I have to hear the constituents. There's no doubt about that. And I've been doing a lot of that lately.
Thank you. That is a great question. My career was all about sitting down with people who had way different opinions on things like bison coming out of the park or elk in the Madison or river recreation on the Bighorn Beaverhead. Really strong opinions, and I made a kind of a career out of figuring out how to address a diverse set of interests. And similar to what Randy suggested, a big part comes from listening, and it comes from approaching any discussion with you or any other constituent with humility and compassion. And I have to be able to put myself in your shoes and try and understand what your perspective is in order for me to really take that in and reflect that in how I respond on a particular issue, ask questions on a particular issue, or vote on a particular issue. Thank you.
So, sorry, I laughed there because I actually cross-examined Pat Flowers on the bison issue at one point in time. I have fond memories of that. That was always good. Any attorney is going to tell you that one of the most important parts of being an attorney is exactly what they were saying, listening. It's compromise. It's negotiation. I represent, and I see some of you out there, I represent HOAs. That is a huge part of what I do. So I wade into the most contentious issues. And we're not talking just the puppies and kitties. We're talking water, sewer, view sheds, property values. And I help them find solutions where they never thought solutions could be found. And that's what I do. That's what I'm trained to do. And, you know, by electing me, you get that trained advocate working for you and Helena. And I will pick up the phone, I call people back, and I communicate with them. That's part of my job. I have to do that. And so that's just part of what I do on a day-to-day basis for my community. My community is not only Gallatin County, Madison County, Park County, but right now I represent HOAs, over 400 of them, across Montana. And they all hear back from me.
I'm running to represent solely the citizens of House District 64. In my opinion, the way that we allow campaign contributions, campaign assistance across districts really shouldn't be allowed whatsoever. If I'm running for House District 64, then I should be focused solely on the interests of the voters in House District 64. There are, as you said, it's a really diverse district, a lot of competing interests. But in my mind, public policy should never be applied. If we create public policy that benefits you but harms another, then that should not be public policy. The only thing that should be done at the state level is to make sure that you are able to do the things that you need to do to help yourself versus creating a specific public policy that benefits you and hurts another.
You know, Claudia, I would say I hear you. I get it. The district is diverse. And what I would say is I think that there's more common ground with people than we really realize. I think that sometimes we get kind of caught up in the rhetoric or the issue du jour of whatever's making us crazy at that time. But at the end of the day, when we kind of sift through the rhetoric and I hear people, sometimes what I'll hear is they're from different political parties, but they're actually saying remarkably the same thing. And they have very similar viewpoints. They might use different words or terms to describe it, but they actually have a lot of common ground. And I think for me personally, I just try to look through the lens that I shouldn't be arrogant enough to think that I know it all. That to come, I think what Senator Flowers said, with humility to the table, that other people just might know more about that topic than you, and they have something good to say. That's what I think. Thanks for that question, Claudia.
Jennifer, do you want to speak to that?
Thank you. I agree with a lot that has been said, but when I talk to folks, I hear the same that needs that across the boards. They want opportunities for their kids, a good education. They want to have the ability to afford respectable housing. They want successful careers and businesses, and they want to live in this wonderful place of Gallatin County with mountains and farms and rivers and abundant wildlife. And I haven't heard anyone who said they want to just live inside and not interact with their community. So there's a lot of common ground.
You're next.
This is for the those that are running for the legislature. There's a couple areas that I think we've all seen and are concerned about. For example, the Department of Corrections and the City Hospital. Both of those are in critical need of staff. And if they don't get a lot of people that die, they'll hurt. Do you have any suggestions or solutions?
Thank you for the question. Going back to one of the previous questions about the budget surplus, this kind of relates to that in that I don't know how budgeting works in your house, but it probably works pretty much the same as it does in my house. Sometimes I make, one month a year I get a big bonus from one of my employers, or I get an extra job for my consulting and get a little bit extra money. Well, we don't just blow that money that month. That money has to skate us by through the rest of the year. So in Montana's budget cycle, you don't just take a budget surplus and just get rid of it just because you overcharge that one month. That goes back into services that are long-term maintenance needs that we've underfunded for a long period of time. It's unfortunate that we have to rely on the government to provide so many of these services, but some of these services, like you said, they're the job of the government. And if I were to take that budget surplus, it's the specific issues of mental health and the pension that I would put these back into. They've been underfunded and under-maintained for quite a while.
By the way, the less you move the mic, the less noise it makes.
I'll do my best. I wish I had more than a minute on this. So I've been recently to the Montana State Prison and the Montana State Hospital, and what I can say is that it is just an absolute shame that, I mean, honestly, our people in the Montana State Hospital receive less mental health services than those in the prison. I mean, it's tragic. I think a lot of it can be, we're dealing with workforce issues. That's what's really driving the cost up. That's the main driver of it right now, and everybody's suffering from that, whether you're in construction or healthcare or prison system. But there are some things that could be done. For instance, in the Montana State Hospital, we pay $855 a day for a person to stay there, while in our nursing homes, we pay $250 a day for our patients to be there. If with just a very minor increase in our rates to our nursing homes, we could move some of those people that are in the Montana State Hospital and provide them a higher level of care, the higher level of care that they need in their own communities where they can be near their family members. So it's one of the amazing places that I really like to find in policy where we do good by our money, right? We invest our money wisely, and we do good for the people that we're supposed to be caring for. So thank you.
Alana, do you want to speak to that?
Thank you. So I worked for Judge Mark Gunther when I was a baby attorney, and many of you knew him and loved him and passed away. He passed away in office. We worked a lot with the state hospital. We worked a lot with mental care. The courts do. And so I am very, I also have a degree in psychology. I worked for the Boys and Girls Ranch for quite a while. And these are critical care issues. These are not things we should be underfunding at all. And there are a number of ways that we can look at attempting to fund them, whether it is from the surplus, whether it is from doing different offsets. I would look carefully at the having our state elder care system pay more and people in there, because they too are also having issues with funding. So there are, I think, in personally, one, yes, these need to be addressed, absolutely. And two, we need to find space in our budget for them, and that will be something that I look at very carefully.
The state hospital tragedy that's unfolding right now, I think, is just one piece of the larger mental health crisis that we have in the state. And part of that is a product of underfunding. The case of the state hospital, we didn't get there overnight. That's been evolving over time. And my approach would be to kind of declare it the crisis it is, and you know, put a, like the governor just created his task force for housing, create the task force for mental health, bring all the professionals together, and come up with a solution to address the problem. It's a critical part of our state mental health program, and I think we need to find a way to fix it. My expertise is more on the natural resource end, and I don't serve on those committees, so I can't give you any more details other than that, but that would be my kind of common sense approach. Thank you.
A lot has been said, and I just need to add a couple things. We do need to fund Gallatin Rest Home. My mother-in-law was there a couple years ago, and it's a very well-run organization, and we, as conservative as I am, there are certain things we do need to fund, and that's definitely one of them. We have a cannabis tax that's coming in that I think might be able to be used for a portion of that for funding some of these things.
Yes, the woman in the striped shirt in the back.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I wanted to ask the candidates a question regarding medical freedom in the context of school exemptions. Currently in Montana, we have two exemptions. We have a medical exemption and a religious exemption that our children can take and get out of, you know, the vaccine schedule, basically. My question is this: would you support a personal belief exemption bill that would apply to all types of education? So we're talking about daycare, all the way through high school, college, even some, you know, med school, if you would. Please explain if you would support that kind of a bill. Thank you.
Who wants to be it?
Thank you. I may have communicated with you via email over the last day or two, and if not, it's a great coincidence, because I have been thinking about it based on that email conversation I've been having with a voter. And my feeling is that I would want to talk with education professionals, and I'd want to talk with physicians in order to assess the risk. I grew up in an era where we got vaccines. My kids got vaccines. It was just what you did to protect kind of the larger community. And so I'm not willing at this point to just take a broad brush and say, yeah, you can do it if you want to. There was good reason why we got rid of polio and got rid of tuberculosis. And it was because of more or less universal vaccines. So I would want to, like I said, go to the physicians, go to the educators, and get a sense of how they view the problem.
This is pretty easy. Yes, we need a personal exemption. There have been vaccines that have been necessary in the past, but we no longer have issues that cannot be treated. And we do not need vaccines for things that can be treated.
I would have to say that I would not support creating a new law when both the U.S. Constitution and the Montana Constitution provide us personal autonomy. So long as you are making choices for yourself that do not injure your neighbor, then you should be able to make those choices. You do need to be held civilly liable. If you damage or you harm your neighbor, then you should be held civilly liable. But both the U.S. Constitution and the Montana Constitution guarantee you bodily autonomy.
Strangely, we agree. I'm a big proponent of the Montana Constitution's right of privacy. And I pretty much agree with what you say there, and probably the attorney in me, where you follow the law. The law grants you privacy. And if you're not harming the person next to you, then you're fine. And if you are, I also believe in the civil liability. So, strangely, I'm going to echo you this time. And thank you. I appreciate the question.
Yeah, I'll say that I struggled with this one through the legislative session. You know, I have a master's in public health, and I'm a card-carrying immunization lover, I'll admit it. But when I really started down thinking down this pathway, in the end, the Constitution wins for me every time. And so I do support a personal exemption. I tend to agree with Randy. I mean, I never thought we would have been able to cure things like hepatitis C, HIV. I mean, it's amazing, right? The miracle of science is amazing. So I think that even though it's been sort of an intellectual struggle for me, just because my professional background, that's where I've ended up. So thank you.
In the middle? Pardon? Would you just ask your question? Okay.
Thank you. So in 2019, Warden of Psychiatrists described treatment of trans-identified children as possibly the greatest scandals in medical history. Europe and Australia are evaluating their guidance to address social contagion and the high possibility of misdiagnosing. In the USSR, teachers are encouraged to discover as many trans students as possible and to save these students from their transphobic parents. I believe it's time to have a bill which will make it illegal for teachers to secretly from parents affirm students coming out as trans or non-binary. So if you support this bill, you don't say nothing. If you don't support, if you disagree with this bill and believe that people, as the teachers, can secretly from parents transition children, please explain why.
Do you want? I think everybody had trouble hearing it. Please raise your hand if you are willing to stop this. Wait a minute. In the USA, teachers make it a matter of personal pride to discover as many trans students as possible and to save these students from transphobic parents. Please raise your hand if you are willing to stop this and vote for a bill to make it illegal for teachers to secretly from parents affirm students coming out as trans or non-binary. You want me to say the last piece again, or did you get it? You got it? Everybody got it?
I disagree with the premise of the question, so I won't raise my hand one way or the other.
Yeah, sure. Okay, it's a long question. In 2019, world-renowned psychiatrist Christopher Gilbert described treatments of trans-identifying children as possibly one of the greatest scandals in medical history. Europe and Australia are reevaluating their guidelines to address social contagion and the high possibility of misdiagnosing. In the USA, teachers make it a matter of personal pride to discover as many trans students as possible and to save these students from transphobic parents. Please raise your hand if you are willing to stop this and vote for a bill to make it illegal for teachers to secretly, from parents, not telling parents, affirm a student's coming out as trans or non-binary. Now, who wants?
I'm going to take a look at the question here. But
I'll pass the question around.
Thank you. I also disagree with the framing of the question and casting aspersions on our teachers. I have two teenagers, and I hear all the rumors as well. I mean, I hear the rumors about teachers inculcating our kids, and it's just simply not true. If you're a parent and you go to school and you talk with your teachers, you will understand that their teachers have the absolute best intentions for them. My own child is transgender. I had disbelief at the beginning. I thought maybe, you know, that his peers were convincing him, her. But I took my child to three different psychiatrists, all of whom had the exact same diagnosis. And that diagnosis came not from the doctors, but from inside my own child.
I also disagree with the premise of this question. My father worked in the school district for 27 years. My husband works at the Big Sky School District. I know the school district and the teachers well, and I stand by them. This simply is not happening at all. And thank you for sharing your story.
Oh, sure. Pass the question. Jane, do you want to speak to it?
Yeah, I concur with Senator Flowers. I'm not sure that I agree with the premise. And I will say, though, that I get it. It's a scary time. You know, we feel out of control in our world right now. We feel out of control of our kids. Violence, hatred, politics, like it all just feels chaotic and a little scary. So I get it. I'm just not sure if I agree with the details of that question all the way.
Well, I think I agree with the premise, and I think it should be illegal for teachers to secretly be talking to students about trans issues. Those are issues that should be dealt with the parents. We don't need educators trying to convince or talk to our kids about these kind of issues. These are parental issues. They might be real, but they're for the parents to handle.
You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio at 95.9 on your FM dial and kgvm.org. And this is a recording of a candidate forum held on Tuesday, October 18th, 2022 at the Gallatin Gateway Community Center, featuring candidates for House District 64, Senate District 32, and Gallatin County Commission. We will continue the forum in progress.
Another question?
Yes.
This question is for Ms. Meyer. What do you see as the top three challenges to Gallatin County in the future, if one of them is affordable housing, and how would you solve them if one of them is affordable housing? I think we already heard those comments. Thank you.
You're going to do all that in 1 minute.
So, great question. Top three issues for Gallatin County. One is housing and affordability. And I think we have great initiatives underway, and there's more that we can replicate. There's some great work that's already been mentioned in Big Sky that we can bring to the rest of our communities. I think it's really important that we address it as a county. It's a regional issue. It isn't just in Bozeman and Big Sky. All our communities are grappling with that. The second area is around water management. All the snow that falls in Big Sky and ends up in Three Forks is all we get. And so I think it's critically important that we have a proactive drought planning initiative and that we get very smart about
how we are going to grow and develop in a way that's going to conserve that vital resource. And the third area, quite frankly, is just continuing to provide all the services that Gallatin County does, whether that's public safety, mental health, community growth, roads, bridges, parks, trails. I mean, all of those amenities are important.
Yeah, gentleman in the second row.
Hi there. This is for Pat. Pat, if I were a developer and I want to do a development in excess of 5 lots, that has to go to the state for approval. Is that correct? Yes.
Apparently you know better than I do, so that's good.
So my question is, other than DEQ, what value is added to my subdivision request that these people at the local level can't handle, so it's got to go to the state and language there for extra months? Because the bottom line of affordable housing in this county or anywhere else is access to developable land and a process that allows you to do it in an expeditious manner. So what value added do I get by you reviewing my application for a 40-lot subdivision, for sake of discussion, that these guys, oops, can't do both?
You would get absolutely nothing from me reviewing your subdivision. I can guarantee you that. DEQ does have a role to play there. And right. And beyond that, to tell you the truth, I don't know what the other steps are in subdivision review. I thought most of that, yeah, Alana will. I thought most of that was handled at a local level. I can tell you my bias is the more we can make our decisions locally related to subdivision review or just about anything else, I think we'll get better decisions. I think when you're closer to the issue, you get the decision. That makes sense.
The first way you gave, okay, when Doug talked, so that's why I asked the question.
You asked your question.
Okay. Maybe we'll talk after, because I'm not sure I see the inconsistency there, but I'm happy to talk about it.
Hi, Larry. Okay, so there has been some rule changes for a while. The only actual state review that you get in a subdivision application now is DEQ. Most are local. I would also like to see some of the DEQ stuff be more local. There is, and I think that would streamline the process. For the DEQ, there's two types of subdivision reviews. There's the COSA review, the Certificate of Subdivision Approval, and there's the MFE, the Municipal Facilities Exemption. The Municipal Facilities Exemption, there's no reason the state should be reviewing that, because that's simply determining whether or not the sewer system that's part of the municipality has capacity. State doesn't know that. And I'm sitting here with applications. They're sitting here for a year for the state to talk to the county or the city to say, hey, sanitarian, do we have capacity? Literally sitting a year. This is something that could be easily streamlined, and I truly believe this is one step we can take to make it easier to get product to you and get our kids back here and get my friends back here who want to move back.
Thank you. It's been framed earlier that if we stick with the status quo, that essentially the bottleneck is the DEQ. Well, I think that if the bottleneck is the DEQ, then I think that this coalition of developers that I had suggested earlier, they could certainly hire and pay the DEQ to do the work that needs to be done, or they could hire some local environmental engineers to do the same work. We've got to have some veto process at the end where all of the research is reviewed and analyzed. But essentially, I disagree with a state-level, top-down, statewide subdivision approval bottleneck. I think it needs to be done, or options need to be available for that same work to be done at the local level at market rates.
Okay. Yes, ma'am, the woman in the black.
This is back to Medicaid and how we pay for health care. And it's been contentious whether Medicaid expansion would be passed in several legislative sessions. So The next time it comes up will be 2025, I think. And would this apply to the senator candidates? Would you set a candidates? Would you vote to reauthorize it? I have a second part to the question, though, which is that we have a mill baby throughout Gallatin Rest Home, and the administrator did a wonderful presentation, and she explained that our Medicaid is not fully funded by the state legislature, and the Gallatin Rest Home is losing a lot of money on every night.
And your question is?
So that's a two-part question.
Okay.
We get 2 minutes.
Who wishes to speak to that first?
Do we get 2 minutes?
Pardon? Sure, why not? Because it's two questions. Okay, 2 minutes, 2 questions. Okay. Oh, yeah, that's right. Senators, gentlemen, who wants to?
Medicaid. No, I wouldn't want to refund that. When you get the government involved, you're quality of the product goes down and the expense goes up. Just look what happened with Obamacare. I mean, when that was passed, we were supposed to cover all but about 3% of U.S. citizens, and it went from 17%, and it did help. It got it down to 12%. So it didn't do what it was supposed to do, and it became extremely expensive. So I don't think that the government is the answer to our Medicaid problem. So personally, we have an issue in our family, and we have a share program. Okay, so we pay about $500 a month. And our current circumstance, we pay about $20,000 a month in prescription drugs. Okay, that share program handles that, plus procedures that have cost in the hundreds of thousands over the last year and a half, several hundred thousand. Now, there's got to be some way to get private enterprise to be able to figure this out. We need to strip some of the... Obamacare has a problem with... it makes insurance companies cover things that people don't want them covered, and that's making it very expensive. So there needs to be some major reform to our insurance programs, but if a share program can make this happen, then I think the private sector, along with reducing regulations, can be a big answer to this problem.
Thank you. Great question. Yes, I voted for authorizing it in 2019. It took 5 votes in the Senate on the floor and passed on the 5th vote by 1 vote. I expect it to be contentious again, so this is an incredibly important issue as you consider this election. I can tell you why I supported it. It allowed for over 90,000 Montanans who didn't have health care prior to have health care. And having gone through a 12-year process with my wife, who had cancer, who ultimately died of it, I know what those costs are. I know what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck making health care payments. It's devastating. And to not have insurance, I literally can't imagine what that experience would be like without it. So that, to me, is incredibly important. It's also 90% of it's paid for it by the federal government, so it's a kind of a bargain for the state to be able to offer that. It's brought in 5,000 jobs across the state. It's brought in $280 million. It's given us rural health care that we did not have before that would go away if we don't reauthorize expanded Medicaid. This is an incredibly important issue for your neighbors, for all of us in Montana. We, in my opinion, we have to reauthorize it. Thank you.
I would ask that you hold the applause until the end. Who's next?
I would say that I would also agree with reauthorizing Medicare expansion. The issue is, for me, an equal access under the law issue. Either you remove Medicare for everyone, or you allow everyone to opt into it. It's hard to say who is it that qualifies and who doesn't qualify without stepping on somebody's toes. So either if there are people who qualify for Medicare, then that bar needs to be set applied to every person. So reauthorizing the Medicare expansions was. And again, as Senator Flowers said, the vast majority of Montana's rural health care comes from the federal government, which means that Montana gets a little bit of a fair shake when it comes from federal government, with the vast majority of funding for the federal government coming from the population centers. This is where Montana's rural population takes advantage of the fact that we have such wide open spaces.
Yeah, those two questions are good and they're related, maybe not in the way that you're thinking. But so Medicaid expansion has been lackluster at best. So at first we were promised the work requirement. That turned out that never came to fruition. We were never able to enable the work requirement. It's not correct that if Medicaid expansion went away, we wouldn't have uninsured. They go to the health insurance exchange. That's where you get that's what happens in other states who don't have Medicaid expansion. They go to the health insurance exchange. I served on a health insurance company that offers exchange plans for 6 years. I termed out, so that's where they go. There's only so much money to go around. I mean, that's the reality of it. And when there's only so much money to go around and you now try to spread it into a program that could be funded by the feds, right, with the exchange plans that are offered on the exchange, when you start funding it yourself in your state and there's not enough money to go around, then you start having low nursing home reimbursement rates. Medicaid was made for the aged, blind, disabled. That was the original population, and I completely support that. We can't ever let that population down. But we are letting that population down because we've taken scarce resources and spread them now so thin around a population that could have received health care services through the health insurance exchange instead. And now we can't fund our nursing homes. Now we have them closing down, and we don't have enough staff. You heard my example about diverting people from the Montana State Hospital to our nursing homes just by paying our nursing homes enough money. So it is a real problem, and I completely support increasing the rate. There was a rate study that was done in my committee recently, and it showed that we are very much underfunding our mental health services, our children that are in residential treatment, our age-blind, disabled, and nursing homes. There's no question that that is underfunded. But one of the issues is that we're spending money in places that we maybe shouldn't have in the first place, and now we're paying the price.
So you've heard I grew up here, and I grew up here in the 80s, where there wasn't a lot of funding. There wasn't a lot at all. And I had cancer. And my mom and dad, they were very lucky to have health insurance, but I understand very much how important it is to have health care in the area that you live. And our district covers even West Yellowstone, and they have one health care provider down there, Erin. And she does a darn good job, but on very little funding. And everything, I agree with everything that Pat said. We need to have, there are a lot of things that, first of all, that the expansion brought to Montana, the jobs, the funding that mainly comes from the feds, and it is a bargain. Keep in mind, there are people like me out there that are uninsurable. I'm one of them. Hodgkin's lymphoma means you are uninsurable. I can't buy life insurance. I can't buy health insurance. I rely on my husband's because I just end up in there because, again, he's a school teacher. So this type of expansion covers people, even can cover people like me, and it covers 10% of Montanans today. I would absolutely vote for the expansion.
Oh, absolutely.
I realize this question wasn't directed at the county, but I just want to encourage everyone, at the end of your ballot, there's a mill levy regarding our Gallatin Rest Home, and I really encourage everyone to learn about it, go visit it, and become educated. If we do have better state reimbursement, then the cost will not fall on the county, because that is a well-run facility, and it can function if it gets the right reimbursement. But if that does not happen, what is at stake is having a high-level care facility in our community for the people who need it. Otherwise, they'll have to leave. So I really encourage people to do the research. Thank you.
Yes.
Can I have a question?
Absolutely.
The last couple of years, I've heard about a $1.4 billion surplus. And while I never really believed it or expected to see any of it myself, it got a lot of people excited thinking that somehow the government had some of their money. But right here at this little meeting tonight, we've spent that surplus three times. And my expectation is that we're going to be asked to spend that surplus no matter who gets elected. And two questions. Whose idea was it to call this money a surplus and get people all excited thinking that their money is going to come back?
Yes, and the second...
And I would say Mr. Flowers and Mr. Gillette can answer that question because they're already served. The second part of that question is, are we getting prepared for sales tax? We already have fairly high property taxes and we already have an income tax. I don't know if it's higher or not.
Your question, sir.
Are we being set up for, not set up, but prepared to get a sales tax? And if so, are you folks supporting that?
Thank you.
Well, I don't know who the linguist was that came up with surplus, but yeah, clearly a bad idea. I think it's just the product of the biennial budget cycle. We're required actually by law to carry, quote, a surplus for, contingencies. And it's anywhere from, $250 to $350 million as a buffer. So this goes above and beyond that. And it is the product of, in part, the pandemic funding that came from the federal government, and then the income tax receipts from both personal income tax and business income tax that rose, in part, as a product of that federal infusion of cash. So that's how it's happened. I'm for calling it something else, if that was your question. That's probably a good idea. I do think it's a legitimate option to write people checks. I mean, we've done it before, and I think that's going to get serious consideration in the coming legislature. And I think, as I said, my big issue is it should be weighed in the full context of the budget. And looking at the risks that lie ahead, Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I certainly wasn't dodging it, but I missed the second question on the last one too. So, which I do support increasing the rates for the rest home. But sales tax, I was in favor of giving Big Sky the opportunity to increase their sales tax by 1% in the 2019 session. And the reason I like that is because it was then subject to the vote of the people in Big Sky, whether they wanted to impose that tax on themselves. I like that approach, and that's one of the things I like about a local option sales tax, is put it before the voters, let them decide whether they want to impose it on themselves. At this point, I'm not in favor of a statewide sales tax. It pains me to see all the revenue we lose as tourists roll through town and we don't collect on their participation here in Montana. But at this point, no, I wouldn't support a statewide sales tax.
Oh, yeah.
I also think it was bad wording to call it a surplus. I've been the treasurer at my church for the last couple of years, and we run on pretty slim margins. But I think that it would be kind of foolish for us to take any overage that we have in a specific budget year and to put it back in the plate and let people pull from it. There's so many things that we could do at the church that with that surplus money it's just part of the ongoing revenue. And as long as we're not raising rates, as long as we're not asking people to keep increasing the amount of money that they put in the plate exorbitantly, then, and we're running the state, we're running the church responsibly, then if we have a little bit of a surplus one year, then we're not going to put it back in the plate. The other thing about it, the sales tax, I think it's absolutely essential that we allow local communities to decide how it is they want to be taxing themselves. The state controls our income tax, counties control our property tax. The local communities should be allowed to decide how they want to fund their infrastructure.
I would too support, and I have no idea why they call it a surplus other than that's probably an accounting practice. And I deal with those all the time where I'm like, why does it call this? And they say, because it is. Okay. So I would support a local option sales tax. I live in one, and I've seen the benefit of what we can do with it. And the reason that we keep talking about Big Sky is because we have the resort tax funds, and we can move and pivot with those and support certain things that otherwise you could not support. And it also does transfer a lot of the funds to the people who are impacting Big Sky and West Yellowstone, and those are the tourists. They're using our roads. They're using our sewer. They're using all these things, and we're able to offset the cost onto them, as we should be able to. The Big Sky Housing Trust, which I've talked a lot about, exists a large part because we are collecting those resort taxes. And yes, quite frankly, yeah, that increase in the sales tax, that did pass, right? And we did implement it. So we're now at 4%. And we more than happily implemented it because we see the actual on-the-ground benefit of it every single day. So yes, I would support a local option sales tax. I would not support a statewide sales tax because it simply doesn't make sense. I don't think it would ever pass. Eastern Montana is not going to support it, and for good reason, honestly.
That is not a misnomer. That is actually accurate. We do have a surplus. That's exactly what happened. So we had, if I go to all the interim revenue budget committee meetings, and we had record years in income tax. That is what it is driven by. It is not from our ARPA funding, you know, from our COVID relief funding. It's literally because we tax people too much. We could, one more time. It is. I mean, we could give back to all the taxpayers. We could give them back $10,000. And I think you know better what to do with your money than I know what to do with your money. And, well, your wife knows best what to do with your money. But So as far as the sales tax go, we, like in my district, West Yellowstone and Big Sky already have sales tax. We already have laws that that help the resort communities out. I'm not in favor of a city or a countywide sales tax or anything like that. There was a really interesting bill that was proposed a while ago, a few sessions back, where you could have property tax, income tax, or sales tax, but you couldn't have all three at the same time. So you'd have to choose. Because the reality is when you add a sales tax, it's not like your property taxes are going to go down or anything like that. The government is just going to find more ways to spend your money. And so none of it's going to go back to you. So I'm not, I like how we have it right now with our sales tax going to the communities, our resort communities, but I'm not in favor of a county or citywide sales tax.
Yeah, the surplus should be given back to the people. It's their money, and they paid it. And from what I understand, a average household would have received $3,500 back. That could have been very helpful, especially this year. Listening to voters and constituents, I would not have necessarily been in favor of the sales tax for like West Yellowstone and Big Sky. But that would have been a situation where I would have listened to the voters, and if that's what they want and they voted it in, then I think that we have to support that. It sort of goes to the cannabis issue. I'm not really excited that it's legal. That wouldn't have been my choice. But, you know, it is legal now. And so now we have to do the best job we can to regulate that as a business. As far as a sales tax goes, no, I don't think we should have a statewide sales tax.
Is that everybody? Oh, okay. I'm the gentleman in the third row.
Hi, my name is Adam Rolfe, and I'm the latest addition to the Montfort School Board. And as we sit here in the shadow of Gallatin Gateway, our county schools are strained. And so I'm curious to Jennifer if, one, why we don't have mandatory impact fees, and then two, to the rest of the panel, how do you guys see the state's role in supporting our school district?
Can we start with you?
That's a great question. I was knocking doors and spoke to somebody in Three Forks, and because kids from Broadwater County over by Wheat, Montana are going to Three Forks School, her kids now going to Belgrade. So our schools are under a lot of strain. And I don't know if I have all the solutions for that. Right now, we don't require new development to pay impact fees. They can do a voluntary per lot one time. And I think, again, this gets back to development paying for its way and ensuring that the rest of our community is not subsidizing and supporting the impacts of that new development. The roads, the water, the infrastructure, the impacts on schools. So I think we need to have a more modern approach about how we balance that, and we have to make sure that our schools are well resourced so they can respond to those growing populations, particularly Montfort. Not all school districts are growing right now in Gallatin County, but this one is for sure.
All right, so right now we are able, a county commissioner can levy impact fees for a few things: fire and water, sewer infrastructure, police and fire infrastructure, and they're not allowed to levy any impacts for schools. This is a fee shifting issue, and one party is going to say it's going to make the development too expensive. I work for the developers, and they pay them anyway. The impacts to school are three times what the impacts are on the rest combined. My father actually did the study on that. And what we're saying to the schools is, and the people in your community, Montfort, where my kiddo went for 2 years before we moved to Big Sky, is you guys can suck it up. You can pay for it. We're not going to make the people coming in pay for it until they live in their house and are paying property taxes as well. And I do think that's wrong. This is one of my pet issues. I believe that the county commission should be able to levy impact fees not only for fire, water, sewer, infrastructure, and police, but for schools as well. They need that tool, and we have deprived them of it.
So, Adam, I've been thinking a lot about school funding lately, and you might not know this, but last session we passed 9 bills that increased funding to schools. 9. And one of them, actually, I'd be happy to share the data with you, really impacts Montfort. So, like, in a good way. So there was a bill by a really clever legislator up in Sydney, Brandon Lear, Representative Lear, and he figured out a way to modify the school formula to basically backfill funds into that formula from the marijuana revenue. And how that's layered on right now is that schools like Big Sky won't really get too much because they have such high incomes and high real estate value. But of the schools in my district, which is West Yellowstone, Big Sky, Gallatin Gateway, and Montfort is actually the one that benefits the most from it. And actually, in like the next couple years, we'll actually get quite a bit of money from that. Also, I was meeting with OPI, with the chief financial officer of OPI recently, just trying to wrap my head around, because school funding is very complicated. Welcome to the school board. And I was surprised when
Superintendent Arntzen said, every year schools leave money on the table. So then I started asking deeper questions about, like, okay, for my schools, which ones, all the title funding, all their revenue sources, which ones are leaving money on the table? And it's shocking that there are schools, not necessarily Montfortin, but that are every year don't use the funds that are available to them. I think with the respect to the impact fees, on my radar as soon as after Election Day is to reach out to the Yellowstone Club and open up a conversation about, I mean, there's so much building going on right now here. I mean, it really impacts Gallatin Gateway School, Montfortin, of course, but just see, and they're a very caring community. I feel like the leadership, the developers up there are super caring. But ask them to have a sincere conversation about what that might sound like to bring more money to the schools as they're starting to use these areas for their employee housing. Thank you.
Anybody else want to speak to that? Okay. Yes, sir, in the back.
Thank you. I was a little late arriving here in Montana. I got here in 1974. So the expansion and growth of the valley is very disturbing. I was surprised to hear so much. Well, private enterprise will help solve it. How the hell do you think we got in this mess? Private enterprise puts here. Big Sky is not an asset. It's been wrong. I'm a scamming since it originally went in. We came through. We put in a stop sign.
And your question?
Why can we not create a creative tax form in which we tax all second and third homes that are never ready to live in at a higher rate, along with Airbnbs and the VROVs, that should be used for rental, and I'm not. Big Sky should be looked at as a resource.
And your question, sir?
My question is, why are we not looking where the money is to alleviate our tax burden?
Thank you. As I stated before, I completely agree with you that each individual community has its own tax burden, its own infrastructure needs, its own school funding requirements. And if each community decides to create these specific taxes for their own communities, then I absolutely believe that they should be able to do so. I don't believe that the state should suppress the ability for communities to create their own funding mechanisms.
Doug, my understanding is that there is a constitutional barrier to taxing second homes at a different rate than primary residents. Simple answer.
Pat is correct. You can't do it pursuant to the Montana Constitution. And that is a simple answer.
I mean, you'd maybe be interested in, there was a ballot initiative that was being proposed that would, I mean, not perfectly do what you're saying, but it would have that effect of having different tax rates for second homes. So maybe that'll be your referendum that you'll want to support.
Yes, sir. Wait a minute. I called on the guy in the back. I want to make sure everybody gets one question at least. Who wants to ask one?
The question about growth in taxes and how do we handle it. And there's two issues that come to my mind that have brought up. One of them being that maybe one of the solutions to growth is to try to slow it. And another solution to the housing crisis would be, I live next to university student housing. There's rentals. There's 8 kids that live on one side and 5 that live on the other. They pay that to nothing. So one of the solutions possibly, and like your opinion on this, is to reduce or force the university to make students live on campus longer. There are communities I know, other places that do that. So affordable housing.
And your question?
Is that something you might consider?
Okay.
currently there's a few efforts going on with employers providing housing, including our hospital, and the Bozeman School District is actually looking at developing employee housing near their bus barn out by Costco. So it's similar to university-supported housing. I think there's ways that as municipalities in the county can kind of help employers make those investments and provide more capacity for their students and employees in the future. So I think some of that's already happening, and we can work to strengthen those partnerships and expand those opportunities.
Will you repeat the question? Just the question, sir.
I have a question. What is the support inducing the university to make students live on a campus longer so that there's more family housing in the area?
Okay.
The second was, is there an issue about slowing growth? Is that an option?
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah, as someone who had a son recently that went to MSU, you probably know they have to stay there in the dorms for like their first year and so on. And then I was devastated when he moved back home after his first year. So I like this idea. Yeah, keep him there longer. But, you know, the Board of Regents has established that, and it's in our Constitution, that we, the legislature, don't have really much authority over our education system. So it would have to be done, if it was done, it would maybe have to be done through some smooth talking of Jennifer's side of trying to coax them into doing that, because we've found out that when we try and legislate them to do something, they take us to the Supreme Court, which doesn't work out good. So, but I think it's a really interesting idea.
Does anybody else want to speak to that? No? Okay, Pat.
That was going to be my answer on that part of the question. The other question, other part of the question, is about slowing growth. And right now, that's a market-driven sort of outcome. The only thing that, and I'd like to hear Jennifer's answer on this also, the only limit that I think we ought to be looking at for sure is incorporating in our subdivision review at a county level water quantity. And if we keep building without any consideration of water quantity, it will come ultimately at the expense of all of us that have a little straw in that aquifer, and suddenly we may not find anything in the straw. So it sounds to me like Jennifer maybe is headed in that direction.
Okay, one more question, and then we're going to do a two-minute wrap-up that everybody gets. Who hasn't asked a question? Oh, everybody's pointing at you. So I guess you get to ask a question.
My question is for any candidates. For abortions that are not resolved by rape or incest, and do not pose a threat to the life of the mother, up to what gestational age is it okay to terminate the fetus, and who's expecting it?
Did you hear the question? Everybody?
The question, I think, was about what gestational age would you support?
Abort. At what gestational age would you allow termination of the pregnancy? Okay.
Now that this decision is back in the hands of the states, which I agree with, I would still say that that every human adult has bodily autonomy, and that decision should not be made by any government authority. That decision should be made between that person and that person's doctor and that person's own set of moral codes, not the government.
I'm pro-life. I believe in the sanctity of that life as a fetus, and so I would have to say I am pro-life. I think that when you believe in the sanctity of life, you have to stand up for it, and that's exactly what I intend to do. I think adoption is a great option. There is a huge need for people that want to have adoptions, and they're not out there. And I think that that would be a great option for some of these pregnancies. I just lost my train of thought. I think that because I'm pro-life, I think that you, and I believe that that is a life, I think that we need to protect that, and I think you would think less of me if I didn't, if you know I think it's a life, but that I'm going to terminate it. I think we all should value life, and I actually believe that that life is real in the womb. And so that's where I'm at.
I'm an adoptive mom. Adoption's great. I wouldn't change it for the world. I also would never believe that I could make a decision better than a person in a critical situation can with their healthcare provider.
I think I would just echo Doug's comments. I think that decision is not a decision the state should make. It's between a woman, her doctor, and her God.
I just want to make sure that I understand the question. Is this for elective, so not in the instance of rape and incest, and not when the life of the mother is, or the health of the mother? Okay, just want to be really clear on that. You know, I would say it's a great question. It's an interesting one. It's one that medical ethicists spend an entire career trying to figure out. There's some really, if you're interested, I'll show you some really interested manuscripts where they have pro and con. It's really fascinating, actually. So I'm going to take the chicken way out and say I'm not sure when that is, but I'm strongly pro-life. So I'm guessing that it's on the earlier end for me, maybe even at the conception, the time of conception. I disagree with Doug. I think that the state does have a compelling interest. There's another life there. Anytime that there's another life there, the state does have a compelling interest. We have really interesting court cases where you have a pregnant woman and like she gets in an altercation with, you know, her significant other. The baby dies. You know, he hits her. The baby dies. He's then charged with criminal charges for homicide. So we recognize that the baby has rights. I think we struggle with it emotionally, ethically, you know, as a society. It's a very difficult topic for us. As someone who released my first baby for adoption, I know what it's like. I get it. And I think, you know, for me at least, you know, if you're going to make adult decisions and do adult things, then you take adult responsibility in those.
Thank you. I think that abortion should be safe, they should be accessible, and they should be rare. Your right to privacy is one of the most important things in the Montana Constitution because it covers so many things, and here's why. If you carve out reproductive decisions out of the right to privacy, because that's what you would need to do in order to pass any abortion law, and the pendulum swings, guys, then the flip is also true. Just like in China, I can tell you that you need to have an abortion because our population is too big. You need to have a vasectomy because you're not ready to have a child. And I don't want anyone making those decisions either way for me and for my family.
I want to thank all of you for these questions. And what I'm struck by is what kind of weighty decisions these people who are elected have to make. And after they do a brutal campaign, then they have to struggle with all these questions that mercifully I don't have to. So now we're going to do a 2-minute wrap-up from each candidate. And who would like to start first? And hopefully I can get everybody included without excluding somebody just once tonight. All right, that would be helpful.
Then I can be done faster. I honestly, these things like make me crazy. I always get so nervous. So thanks for being patient with me. I just wanted to say that every day my constituents reach out. They're terrified about things like inflation, our economy, being taxed out of their homes, childcare. Some are new college graduates, some are young families, some are on a fixed income. Besides my doctorate and my master's in public health, I have executive level education at Kellogg School of Management, Wharton School of Business, and Harvard within the Institute of Strategy and Competitiveness. I've overseen, or actually still oversee, multi-million dollar organizations. Even as a freshman legislator, I've demonstrated my deep competency by being the freshman legislator with the most bills passed in 2021. And I'm the recognized expert in health and human services. In fact, I passed policy that saves taxpayers millions of dollars. My district wants someone who's experienced, that'll safeguard everything that they've worked so hard for. I have a proven track record and of experience and effectiveness tempered with compassion and common sense. And I'm just going to, how many seconds do I have left? And I'll try and rattle off some of my bills. But I'm going to, how many seconds? 50. Okay, good. One of the bills that I've written is one to stabilize our current property taxes that requires bonds or levies to be passed by a two-thirds vote instead of a simple majority. My second one is to increase home visiting programs for at-risk families. So instead of having children removed from homes because of abuse and neglect, we get families the services and help that they need. My third bill is to establish home-based child care facilities as being considered a residential use of property and covenants. My fourth is to restructure our state's existing funding so as to increase child care provider wages through financial incentives linked to educational attainment and career longevity. My fifth is to require the state to provide local governments with favorable land lease terms for the purposes of building housing. And then I have quite a few more if you'd like to hear from me afterwards.
Thank you.
I don't have much to say in closing. I think you've heard a lot of things. I do hear your concerns about the expense of living here, about the growth, having been born and raised here, having grown up here and biked down this road and hiked up in the mountains. This matters to me. This county and this district matter to me, and I want your concerns to be heard at the state legislature. I'm raising my kids here. I plan on living here the rest of my life. We've only touched tangentially upon environmental quality issues. We didn't even talk about public land access. But public lands need to be used for what they're intended for, which is a state revenue, but they need to be run in such a way that we do not lose access to them. And at the same time, we need to make sure that the one thing that drives the biggest driver of our economy, which is tourism and agriculture, do not get defouled by industry. Thank you. And please talk to me afterwards.
Okay, I view this as a job interview to represent you and Helena, and I bring a lot to the table. I bring two decades of experience that is spot on for exactly what you want your legislator to do in Helena. I am a known problem solver. We didn't touch on a lot of the work that I do, but I work a lot with HOAs, and as you can imagine, they are some of the most litigious types of people when you walk in, and they are arguing about things like what? They're mini cities, guys. They're arguing about roads, water, sewer, density, view shed, and property values, and I'm the person that they come to and hire to create legislation and create wording that is going to protect all of those things for the community so they can live their way of life. And that's what I would do for you. I'm a trained advocate and negotiator. I sued to keep public access open. I was the attorney on the Bear Canyon case that put the trail back in next to Bear Creek for everyone to enjoy. I also am a known moderate. I have a Republican father and a Democratic mother, and they raised me, and we talked about it at the table, and they raised me to understand both sides, that both sides have positive things that they're bringing to the table, and I will look at both sides equally and find, hopefully, a common ground and consensus in the middle and build from there and get you laws that actually address the issues in Montana. Most of you would probably hire me to represent you in court. I mean, that's what I do. And you would pay me a lot of money to do that. So why not hire me to represent you in Helena at a fraction of the cost that it would usually take for me to represent you? You know, put me
at these issues, like housing, when we didn't talk on childcare, of access to the public, of access to legal, to the courts. Put me to work because that is what I want to do anyway.
First, thanks again to the Willing Workers Ladies Aid for hosting this. Thanks to all of you for taking your time out of a beautiful spring or fall evening to come and sit and ask great questions. I think this is exactly what's supposed to happen. You saw some policy differences, and it gives you hopefully a basis for making a decision. I am a public service at heart. That's what I did in my career. That's what I learned at home. That's what I learned at school, that my job in part was to serve. And so that's why I wanted to run for the state Senate, and that's how I fundamentally view my job, is serving you. And so that's what you can expect from me when you contact me. One of the best parts of the job, and I've explained this to my wife, is trying to address issues that come up with communities or individuals. And I've had several during the course of this cycle where I've met people at their door and they've had issues not being able to get emergency housing assistance or their SNAP benefits or their appointment at the DMV. And in every case, I can usually give them some help. And that's part of the job that I really enjoy and I'd like to continue. We have lots of challenges and we have a lot of opportunity right now, and I think we need to view it, view our current circumstances as both. And I'm hopeful that with the will of the folks in this valley that we can allow ourselves to develop in a way that's that we're all satisfied with. You can expect me to be honest, transparent, and responsive as your senator, and I hope with that you'll give me your vote on November 8th. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming. I think it was a nice forum, and I think everybody laid out their positions very well. I think it's become very clear some of, for you folks, who you would want to vote for. One interesting thing that I had at a door here a couple weeks ago is this couple came out, and they were both chatting with me, and their mental health was a very big issue to them. And as we went on and discussed it, they were very much into this issue. And as they continued, I'm like trying to, you know, read between the lines. And he just came right out and he said, you know, it's interesting, but Republicans, I think, tend to be more sympathetic and more of help in the mental health industry than Democrats. And that kind of surprised me, his position there. And he went on to say, it's because they are willing to reduce the regulations. You see, we're losing mental health clinics because there's too much regulation. And they can't abide by all the additional regulations. So we're losing that help. And so I think that kind of is a bit of where I'm coming from. I think I believe we want smaller government. We want more efficient government. We want less taxes. I believe you can spend your money better than we can as a government. I'm pro-life. Pat's not. He wants Medicaid expansion. I don't.
Pro-life also just have a different...
Okay, pro-life, he just want, he... No, stop. Okay, he wants people to have the option of have an abortion. Is that...
Yeah.
Okay. So, I didn't mean to offend you. I'm sorry that I didn't say that correctly. Okay. So I think it's very clear. You know, I'm a conservative Republican. He's a more liberal Democrat. So I think the choice is clear.
Let's not apply labels. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much, and have a great evening.
Thanks, everyone, for showing up tonight. It was really great to hear everyone's questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. So thanks for organizing. I want to encourage everyone to take a strong cup of coffee when you fill out your ballot and make sure you get all the way down to the county level. There's a lot to get through. So come prepared and fueled up. Our county government plays a vital role in how we manage complex issues that we are facing today. It's infrastructure, how we're going to grow as communities, public safety, social services. And I have some practical experience that has built enduring solutions. In the Big Hole watershed, I worked with diversity of local governments, outfitters, irrigators, conservationists, outfitters and guides, and we crafted an enduring drought plan for that watershed through four counties that still works today. So I am so committed to bringing together people to solve problems from the ground up. The Triangle Community Plan and Trails Plan is another great local example of collaborative work solving critical issues. I have experience building partnerships, facilitating consensus, crafting local policy, and doing public engagement. We need more forums like this all the time to bring people together and talk about what our communities are facing, and I'm excited to do that at the county. I look forward to talking to everybody more. I have a website and social media. More information is there. I would love it if you took a moment and looked into it. The phone number there is the same one my mom uses. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
What a great group you are out here. And thank you so much to the candidates for running and for allowing this to be a civil and kind, and the audience as well. So thank you very much. Drive safely. Have a good evening.
That concludes the candidate forum held on Tuesday, October 18th, 2022, at the Gallatin Gateway Community Center, featuring candidates for House District 64, Senate District 32, and Gallatin County Commission. KGVM does not endorse any candidate or take a particular position on any ballot issue. We strive to disseminate available information to help voters make informed decisions.